The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Now as I was young and easy under the apple boughs about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb, golden in the heydays of his eyes.
I've been in seven times in from the Milkwood, and I feel really proud of it. I didn't like the play before, but the more you go into it, it's so funny.
They had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light.
I put a request in to the town council last night to ask them to get a grant to have Dylan put in bronze. I think he deserves that.
And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard, and singing as the farm was home in the sun that is young once only, time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means.
And green. Bill Clinton adores his work. Bob Dylan paid him the ultimate compliment of adopting his name. The man who brings former US president and one of the world's most prominent singer-songwriters together in a chorus of assent is, of course, Dylan Thomas, the Welsh poet who was born 100 years ago this autumn. The celebrations, though, are well underway. There are stage plays, TV films, festivals, and not just in Wales, but across the world, especially in the US. For this man probably has a better reputation abroad than in his homeland. There continue, however, to be questions about whether he is a great poet or a Welsh windbag most notable for his bad behaviour, or, as he memorably put it, for throwing up over half the loyal readership of the Western Mail. Wales, needless to say, has firmly decided in his favour, and our reporter, Stephen Morris, went to Thomas's home village of Larne for their Dylan Festival.
This is the bustling bar at Brown's Hotel in Larne, the seaside town in Carmarthenshire, southwest Wales, where Dylan Thomas spent the last years of his life. He liked to moulder, as he put it, in this bar, and wrote at a wrought iron table in a corner facing the front door.
Well, I used to serve him in the shop, right? He used to come in for wine, with friends from London or whatever. He was all right, you know, but he wouldn't talk to us girls, but he talked to our bosses, Mr. and Mrs. Jenkins, because we were young, you know. And his wife then, she'd come in for a shopping. A little bit feisty, like, full of herself. And quite temperish. If we didn't have what she wanted, I've seen him walking around Larn. Well, I know he's a genius.
Not when we knew him.
No, when we knew him, he was just an ordinary person to us. As for talking to him, I mean, we were too young for him to talk to us.
Betty,
what was he like?
Very nice. Very nice. Very abrupt. He used to call me Becky. And I remember him coming over one day and he had a tin of sardines. And he said to me, Becky, he said, "No, what sardines?" And I said, "It's some sort of a fish." So he was eating it then, and he had a pineapple. And he turned around and he cut the pineapple. He said, "You bet, have you tasted pineapple?" And I said, "No, no." So he said, "You are, have a taste of the pineapple." But it tasted of sardines. Yeah. And I went, "Ugh." And he told me, "Don't be such an unappreciated girl, Becky, you'll have enough." So we used to go and drink his cider then. He was a sociable fella, because we used to play by ear, because it used to be an undertaker's carpenter. We used to come out to the Brown, in his tartan shirt, you know. I thought he was a gentleman. Yeah. I don't remember him really being drunk. I remember David Evans, Gerald Moseley and I then, we're all going over there. And of course Mrs. Thomas used to come outside the boathouse. And when the tide was right in, she used to strip and jump in the water. Yeah. Of course with the boys and all us girls would be there. She had a beautiful figure.
Very attractive woman. Well, as you know from the films, isn't it?
Because sometimes my father used to say, like, they used to go down to the cross house then, and she used to get drunk, like, you know, and she'd strip off and run around the cross and all the men. My father came home with a broken arm once, like, my mother said, because he was chasing her.
In this, the centenary of Thomas's birth, it's a great place to bump into locals like Kitty and Betty, who knew him, and to meet the poets and pilgrims who journey here to pay homage. Here's poet and Dylan enthusiast John Lindley.
Well, it's pretty special. I mean, I had performed at one or two other Dylan Thomas related places. I've performed three times in the birthplace at 5 Cumduncan Drive in Swansea, and last week I was brought over to reading Welsh Mam's Day. It's a big kick to be performing here. You know, standing here in this corner where he and Kathleen used to drink, it's something special. And with the new collection out as well, obviously there are certain poems in it that naturally relate to this, his last home.
How do you think Thomas is remembered now?
In the poetry world, not well, I don't think. I think he's been out of favour for quite a number of years. And I think that might be something to do with the old complaints of a little bit of style over substance, that the poetry sounds wonderful, but does he actually mean anything? I think it has to be remembered as well that he wasn't just a poet, of course. He wrote screenplays, he did documentary footage, short stories. But the poems that I think are wonderful, I think it's time. There's been a lot of stripping down in language, necessarily so in poetry, but I think there's still a place. I think that's gone to a degree where it's made some poetry seem very ordinary, and I think there's still a place left for someone who had just an absolute love of language and poured that out into the poems. And I don't think they were stream of consciousness. We all know that he crafted, he was an incredible craftsman. As to how he's viewed in Wales, I think in terms of certain places like Swansea, for a good while he was seen as something of an embarrassment.
Also drinking in Brown's is John Bradshaw, the foreman of Larne's grand jury, the arcane body that oversees the equivalent of the town's council.
And you were performing today as well?
I was, yes. I was Captain Cat.
So what do you think of Dylan Thomas?
It's sort of hard to say, because I grew up with that image of Dylan Thomas and knowing all about him and knowing, probably being more aware of his weaknesses than of his strengths. I remember his children were in school with me, and he was just somebody who just lived in Larne. And he was a rather posh guy who went away quite a lot to London. And occasionally we'd hear him on the radio. Larne is a great leveller. People have a huge disrespect for celebrity here, actually. Yeah, they tolerate him and they embrace him, but they don't want him to get... It's just like having a new neighbour. They don't want him getting too uppity, in a sense. You know, and we've got so much going for us anyway that we see it as rather... Not in a position, but, yeah, you know, yeah, he was here, and so what? But he came here, and, you know, I suppose the way we'd look at it is he came here because Larne was a quirky, interesting place to come to. You know, so we discovered him rather than him discovering us.
Outside, the town hall bell is ringing to signal the start of a Thomas-themed street play. The poet's own descriptions of the town croak out from a speaker.
I've been living now for 15 years or centuries in this timeless, beautiful, balmy, bird-spellings town. In this far, forgetful, important place of herons, cormorants, known here as biddy duckers, castle, churchyard, gulls, ghosts,
an actor playing a character from Thomas's playful voices Under Milk Wood sings.
Come and sweep my chimney, come and sweep my chimney, come and sweep my chimney.
Parked across the way is the Dylan Thomas Mobile Bookshop, a truck stocking hundreds of Thomas tomes, run by Jeff Towns, chair of the Dylan Thomas Society of Great Britain. Even he has learnt new things about Thomas this year.
I've realised, I think, that we tend to focus on just three or four poems under Miltwood and not much else, whereas if you do take the trouble to go back to the short stories and to look beyond Fernhill and Do Not Go Gentle, you know, I constantly am reminded that he is first and foremost a great writer. You know, and because we only look at certain poems, but I was with Gwen Watkins yesterday, who knew Dylan, and she's in her 90s now, and she was very keen to talk to me about the poems he wrote for the Second World War. And there's about three poems. He was in London, The Refusal to Mourn the Death of a Child, On the Death of a Man Aged 100. They're magnificent.
What about his image? Often we think of the drinker. Yeah. Is that fair as you've...
Yeah, I've written a book called Dylan Thomas, The Pubs. I think the first sentence in it is something like, Dylan Thomas liked beer, but he loved the pub. And you can't take drink out of Dylan Thomas's life. You can't take women out of his life, or he was no Lothario. You can't take pinching people's shirts when he stayed with them. Those kind of little things, but you can reposition them. Another book I published was six unpublished love letters to his first mistress. Passionate letters, and if you look in his collected letters, you could put one of these letters, the date of it, next to a letter to Caitlin, and you could almost switch the names around. They're great love letters. I mean, if you're a great poet, you can write a great love letter. And he'd started this legend, I think. You know, especially when he went to America, he sort of decided they wanted a rambunctious, bohemian, larger-than-life poet. And he thought, well, if that's what they want, that's what I'll give them. I think, sadly, when he started to drink whiskey in America, the line between the act and his real persona got blurred. Immediately after his death, and he's dead then, so he can do nothing about this, Richard Burton takes him on board. Dylan had asked Burton for a loan just before he went to America on his last trip. Burton didn't have the money. Dylan went and died. Burton was so distraught, he kind of took on Undermilk Wood and made it his own. And if you look at Burton's career and his diaries, he wanted to be a writer. And if he could have been anyone, he would like to have been Dylan Thomas. So Burton takes on Dylan, and that suddenly links Dylan Thomas with celebrity, wealth, Elizabeth Taylor, Cleopatra, all of that. And then a little while later, this little Jewish folk singer called Robert Zimmerman changes his name to Bob Dylan. And that's another way that Dylan Thomas is kept up there in this pantheon. And then a little while later, Sergeant Pepper comes out, and in the middle of all those folk is Dylan Thomas. And then, you know, I can turn around here and pick up a beer mat that's got Dylan Thomas quotes on it. You don't often go into a pub and find T.S. Eliot on a beer mat or Ezra Pound. Dylan Thomas somehow seems to be able to bridge high and low culture, and a lot of it's to do with this image.
From places as distant and improbable as Tonopendy or even England, and have now been absorbed by the natives.
He looked, someone once said, like an unmade bed. But nobody could be so unkind as Dylan's description of himself. Above medium height, for waves, I mean, 5'6½". Snub nose, curly, mouse brown hair, one front tooth broken after playing a game called Cats and Dogs in the Mermaid Mumbles. Speaks rather fancy, truculent, plausible. A bit of a shower off. Plus fours and no breakfast, you know. A bombastic, adolescent, provincial bohemian with a thick knotted artist's tie made out of his sister's scarf. She never knew where it had gone. And a cricket shirt dyed bottle green. A gabbing, ambitious, mock-tough, pretentious young man.
40 miles east of Larne is Swansea, the city where Thomas was born, with, inevitably, under Milkwood in the background, Swansea Council's literature officer, Joe Ferber, gives me the tour.
Feeling her a jocking word. Saw him in the bushes, laying locking. Send him to bed without any...
This is a picture of Dylan when he was about 2 years old, looking very young and innocent. As we know, a lot of his writing was about being born in Swansea, growing up in Swansea, One of his most famous and best-loved broadcasts, Reminiscences of Childhood, begins, "I was born in a large Welsh industrial town at the beginning of the war." And visitors to Swansea today can still see Dylan's ugly, lovely town, follow in his footsteps, see some of his favourite haunts, where he lived, where he worked and where he played, and which had such a profound influence on his work.
And how is he perceived in Swansea now?
Swansea is very proud to have Dylan as one of its most famous sons. He's someone who brings an enormous number of visitors from all over the world to Swansea. We've had visitors from over 70 different countries through the doors in the centre. He's always been a significant figure internationally, partly because of those visits to America, but also to Italy, to Persia, to Czechoslovakia. He's still got a tremendous reputation as an international writer of great stature. His work has also been translated into over 30 different languages, I think it is. There's a Mandarin Chinese version being worked on at the moment in Swansea. So his work is, I think, reaching further afield all the time.
While Mr. Waldo, rabbit catcher, barber, herbalist, cat doctor, quack, dreams of...
This little piggy went to market.
This little piggy stayed home.
This little piggy had roast beef.
And this little piggy had none.
And this little piggy went wee, 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 all the way home to Waldo's mum.
Waldo!
Oh, what'll the neighbours say? What'll the neighbours?
Black as a chimney.
Ringing doorbells.
Breaking windows.
Making mud pies.
Stealing currants.
Chalking words.
Saw him in the bushes.
Playing mutchins.
Send him to bed without any supper.
Give him centipods and lock him in the dark.
Off to the reformatory.
Off to the reformatory.
He wrote about what it was like to be a teenager and want to move away. He wrote about what it was like moving away and then missing the place. His letters are full of amazing anecdotes, descriptions of Swansea, Gower, West Wales. And it really is possible to walk around with a collected Dylan Thomas, something like the Dylan Thomas Omnibus, and you can see the places that he wrote about. And he's someone, of course, that continues to inspire many writers, artists, filmmakers today. He's someone who continues to inspire people today. One of the things we try and do at the centre is also to give a platform for contemporary writers, because, of course, we celebrate Dylan with our permanent exhibition and our Dylan Thomas Festival, but we're also here to celebrate the work of contemporary writers, from the 11-year-olds who come to our Young Writers Squad through to established writers like the Poet Laureate, who comes here every year.
Back in Larn, I cross a stream near Thomas's Heron Priested Shore and head to the Fountain Inn, where Welsh poets Patrick Jones and Rhiann Edwards are performing.
Years ago you wrote Pro Patria Mori, the old lie, their old lie, and you warned us, yet no one heard, and your words drifted like ash in the November sky, because now, today, still, young men and women are sent to another trench, in another country, for another man's pride to fight another man's war. But only if you don't matter to the country you're fighting for.
So is Dylan Thomas an important figure for you?
Yeah, in some ways, just the love of language and the freeingness, if that's a word I would like to use. Not so much about his stance on many issues or life in general, but I think he sort of liberated me in thinking about poetry when I was younger in a wider sort of way than the way it was taught. And the way he would have a noun, an adjective, another noun, bouncing off each other. It's always sort of excited me, I think. So he was quite pivotal to my sort of love of poetry, I think, as simple as that, perhaps. And even now, I have no idea what he's on about sometimes, but I still read it, and I still go into schools, and I'll share Dylan Thomas poems with kids, and I'll say, let's look at how he describes that tree, or that sun, or that walking on the beach, and they get it. Kids get it, and off they go with their own writing. So I've kept it alive, even if you know what I mean, passing on to workshops I've been doing with the Dylan Thomas Centenary Project.
Especially growing up in South Wales, he's generally your first introduction to poetry. I mean, I was weaned on that. You know, I was quoting that probably by the time I was about 12. His use of language, I parallel. I think as a Welsh writer, you always try to stamp your own imprint without it sounding too much like Dylan Thomas. But somehow echoes of him just seem to kind of spread, you know? His very muscular attention to language and the very musical and lyrical kind of lilt he attributes to language. I mean, I think that also comes from being a musician as well, and the sound of the words being so important. I started doing a very strange thing, actually. I was going through all his poems and writing down every different sort of synonym he had for the sea or the river or a farm. And it was just, I think I had like 60 different synonyms he had just to describe the sea, the Tusk Sea, the Ramshackle Sea. And again, it's that muscularity. It's that active and sort of visceral kind of language of the Ozarks Oaks for, I think, has definitely kind of percolated into my style.
Before June it ends, my life it descends in the wake of a little plutonious it does. In the wake of a little blue pill, now me mouth a fluffer, and me paw's a fluffer. And I want a fluffer the same.
Over at the Millennium Hall, poet Murray Lachlan Young is entertaining a rapt audience with a risque piece of performance poetry Thomas probably would have enjoyed. Lachlan Young is writing a screenplay for an Under Milkwood film. He is sure Thomas still has much to offer.
If you look at Burns in Scotland, I mean, I think Thomas in some ways is moving into that, occupying that sort of area of national consciousness. I think for Wales, you know, it's very easy to just to rubbish writing, and a lot of people do that to Dylan Thomas, and there are reasons that they do it. But I think for people pointing fingers at him, they're also pointing back at themselves quite heavily, because I don't see the point in trying to discredit somebody who is actually, his work is still of such huge service to the international perception of Wales and the Welsh people, and also Wales's relevance. I mean, so whether he is or he isn't relevant to an individual, I think the larger relevance of what he represents as a manifestation of Welsh creativity, I think that's where people should be looking and understanding that, you know, there's still room for everybody. And I think there's certainly room for Dylan Thomas.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against a dying of the light.
You see, even Stravinsky was so moved by Dylan Thomas's death that he was inspired to write this piece of music. Jeff Towne's book, Dylan Thomas, The Pubs, is published by the Welsh company Lolfer. Here now to discuss the controversial work, The Poetry, are our resident Swansea man and poetry editor Nick Rowe and Hilly Janes, who has just published a biography of the man her father painted, entitled The Three Lives of Dylan Thomas.
Hello there, Hilly, and welcome, and many congratulations on your book, which I see is picking up some nice reviews around the place.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're in a very special position to go back through all three of Dylan Thomas's lives, through your family connection, with your father, Alfred James, who was not only a friend of Thomas, but was also the artist who produced some of the most iconic images of him. Now, they were friends in Swansea as young men in the early 30s, but they weren't alone. There was a group of writers, musicians, artists, other clever young men and women who, like your father, went on to impressive careers in the arts. Do you want to say a little bit of the world that Dylan emerged from?
Yeah, well, Swansea in the 1930s was a place that had been quite badly hit by the Great Depression. You know, Swansea was a hugely important centre of the Industrial Revolution. It had the nickname Copperopolis for its copper smelting. And, of course, all the coal came down the valleys into the harbour and out across the Bristol Channel. So before then, my grandparents, Swansea was a very bustling, busy, mercantile kind of town, quite well off. But these boys, Dylan and my father, their friends, Daniel Jones, a composer, Vernon Watkins, another poet, Charles Fisher, who was another writer and very successful journalist, Mervyn Levy, another artist, writer, broadcaster, they were all actually very middle-class boys. None of them spoke Welsh, although all of them had a parent who spoke Welsh, or either both of them, but Welsh was the language of the pits and the farms, and any aspirant person in Swansea would want their child to go to the grammar school and not to speak with a very strong Swansea accent. Their collective name, which my father said was always a bit apocryphal and romanticised was the Cardoma Boys or the Cardoma Gang. And that's because they used to meet in a cafe called the Cardoma in Swansea, which was very near the Evening Post, where Dylan had probably the only full-time job of his life for about a year after he left school at 16. And Charlie Fisher was also a journalist there, although a lot more successful. And my father's studio was just down the road in the high street. And they would meet there for coffee, maybe for lunch sometimes, there's a wonderful description of their chat in Return Journey, Dylan's very moving account of going back to Swansea after it had been absolutely decimated in the war and was still just a pile of rubble, really, right into the late 1940s.
Now, looking back sort of through the telescope of now, looking back to then, it seems as if Dylan is this sort of giant among pygmies. He's the one who's gone to sort of world fame. But as we just talked about, these people had proper artistic careers. They were all successful in their own fields. But what was it that made Dylan sort of leap ahead like that? What brought him to some kind of global fame in a way that very, very few other artists have ever achieved?
Well, I think that's because he was a terrific performer. He was a wonderful actor. He'd always loved acting, even as a little boy. He was the star of the school, prep school show. He went on to do a lot of acting in Swansea and joined the Little Theatre, which was a very vibrant amateur dramatic company in the town that had been set up in the late 1920s by the town's young intellectuals. The university had just opened there, the University College. And they were very ambitious, you know, they put on classical plays, Shakespeare, lots of modern plays that weren't really quite what was on offer in the commercial theatres in Swansea. And he took part in a lot of those, and he had this wonderful voice, and I'm sure the elocution lessons had helped there. And I think he was a very sort of pretty, beautiful little boy with his angelic curly hair. And I think he loved performing, and he responded to an audience. So that once he started broadcasting in the 1940s, during the war, really, he really took off. And I think, I didn't realise this until I wrote the book, that the radio had shut down at 6 o'clock in the evening before the beginning of the war. And of course, they stopped the television altogether. But during the war, to raise people's morale, there was broadcasting all day. And Dylan started to make these broadcasts that were often very colourful, very warm, very funny, affectionate. The first one, I think, was called Reminiscences of Childhood, which is all about his childhood in Swansea, and has the lovely poem The Hunchback in the Park in it that went on to become very famous. So I think he took off there with this wonderful voice and different kind of mood and tone, which cheered people up hugely during austerity.
And how quickly did the reputation as the, this rock star reputation that came along has stuck to him ever since, of, you know, there's the drinking, the womanising, all that side of his life, which has been dragged along behind him ever since. And, you know, and an early death, of course, didn't harm that.
Well, I think, you know, he always liked a drink, and he was always entertaining people in pubs in Soho and Fitzrovia. But one way of looking at this, I think, is that's very interesting, is that what he was trying to do a lot of the time there was get work, and he was trying to impress people who were producers at the BBC, and a lot of them were poets. They were people like Roy Campbell, Louis McNeice, Eric Blair, who then, of course, we all came to know as George Orwell. They were all really, on the whole, public schoolboys who'd been to Oxbridge, and here was this, you know, kid from Swansea who'd left school at 16 and I think was probably actually rather insecure. And this kind of entertaining was a way of getting work, you know, making people like him, also getting people to buy him drinks because he didn't have any money to do it himself. But I think the real rock star status came when he started going to America, which wasn't until the 1950s. And he went on these four tours of the States. And they're quite mind-boggling now. The first one was in 1950. I think he was away for about 4 months, and he gave something like 40 readings back to back, and he travelled mostly on his own around America, which in 1950 was quite a thing to do, especially if really you'd only ever been on the train from Swansea up to Paddington and back. He was hugely popular there again because it was this very different tone, this approach to poetry, which most of the readings took place on university campuses. So he was talking to students who thought of poetry as a very dry kind of academic subject. And here was this very entertaining Welshman who actually at first didn't read his own poems. He would put together an anthology completely written out in hand, and he'd often change it as he went along. So he was a very good showman. He'd play to the audience, and then maybe he'd tack a couple of his poems on the end. But he would sell out a 1,000-seater auditoria in the States quite regularly. But I think it was punishing, and it wasn't financially very well structured, so he kept running out of money and so on. And it made Catelyn, his wife, furious because she was stuck back in Larne in South Wales with three small kids, often during the winter away for months on end. And then he didn't bring any money back with him. But he kept going back for more, partly to earn the money, and I think partly because it was probably a rather welcome escape from what was then a difficult marriage and a financial situation that was really pretty dire.
I mean, and since then, since his death in 53, age only 39, the trajectory of his reputation has gone through a very strange sort of shape. His poetry was popular to a general audience. I mean, a lot of people, you know, bought and liked his poetry, but it fell out of academic favour. Then sort of his reputation, as the things we were just talking about, the rock star stuff, seemed to take it over. And it's only in the last sort of 15, 20 years that he's been sort of almost rehabilitated. When I was brought up in Swansea, my grandparents, who didn't know him, although they had met him, kind of despised him. He was a derided figure, you know, a scrounger and a drunk and all that sort of thing, well thought of. You know, Swansea now, he is the patron saint. You can't move without, you know, with Dylan this, Dylan that. Well, where do you think his reputation kind of sits now, and how is it set as he moves into his second 100 years?
Well, what I hope is that the centenary will eclipse the reputation of the womaniser and the drunk, not completely, and put the work back into the forefront. Because I think, I mean, from where I'm standing in London, I find it very interesting talking to people when I was writing the book. They'd say, well, what are you doing? And I say, well, I'm writing a book about Dylan Thomas. And they would say, literally, drunken would be the first word. And then there might be womaniser or Welshman. And these would be people working in publishing in London. And I was very struck, too, that when I meet people, say, in their 30s and 20s, even, you know, people who've got first-class degrees in English literature from really good universities, Dylan Thomas means nothing to them. And that really surprised me, because just I did Underwood for A-level in a nice girls' school in South London, just completely by coincidence. So I think, as you say, academically he's fallen out of favour. I think critics have always found him very difficult to deal with, because you can't pigeonhole him. He's not a surrealist. He's not a war poet. He's a kind of modernist. There's a lot of romance in his work and lyricism, but he's not a romantic poet. And I think critics and people who set school curricula find that very difficult, because it's much easier to put somebody in a pigeonhole. But I've heard that he's coming back onto some school curricula, so I think that's great, because there's so much for young people in his work, I think, because some of the characters are so funny. The imagery is often, it's very easy to understand, very evocative. He's very good at conjuring up visual imageries, I think, from the written and spoken word. So I hope, too, that he doesn't become just a tourist attraction, you know, somebody who you go down to Larne and buy a mug with his name on it. I hope people do begin to enjoy the poetry again, and the short stories, which are wonderfully evocative, I think. And Undermilk Wood and plays like Return Journey, which I think are completely overlooked.
Thanks very much, Nick and Hilly. I feel I've learned a lot from that. The Three Lives of Dylan Thomas is published by Robson Books. There are many more celebratory events to be found on the Dylan Thomas Centenary website. Next week, we'll be hearing about another world-renowned writer from a small nation, Jo Nesbø, the Norwegian thriller writer. Look out also for Guardian Weekly, which has a special edition on South America, including the favela, slum or utopia, Cuba's new foreign allies and Uruguay's maverick president. Do keep telling your friends about us and get them to subscribe. For now, from me, Claire Armistead, and producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent, and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow-black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles. or blind as kept in cast, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds. And all the people of the loud and dumbfound town
on Mergolai tan gwmwl yn uwch y nos.
Behind the press canion yn holi amdano, di wari i frwydro dros rhaid y dyn.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find.
I forget the new end, farewell am beddi. Mae'r brenin am rebel, am Jack a'i thyr dirgel, gan adael y cythrel, yw hamladd ei hi.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.